This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Susan Zerenda lives in Spartanburg, South Carolina. She has taught literature, composition, and creative writing to high school and college students for more than 30 years. And now she has written her debut novel, Bells for Eli. Next week, Susan will lead a writing workshop and talk about her novel here in Chattanooga. The event takes place Monday night at the Arts Building starting at 7 p.m., part of the Southbound Lecture Series by Southern Lit Alliance. Susan joined us by phone for a conversation, along with Linda Levan of Southern Lit Alliance. Linda, Susan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
So, Susan, this is your debut novel, Bells for Eli.
It is. It is a story that was inspired by an accident that happened to a first cousin of mine in the late 1950s. He was living up in Plainfield, New Jersey, I believe, with his family, and his father, my uncle, was blowing up balloons for Danny's birthday party with Red Devil Lye, and I have learned that Red Devil Lye has properties like helium. So he had it in a Coca-Cola bottle, and I assume he was putting the lip of the balloon over the bottle and blowing it up, and he left the bottle on the steps, and Danny picked it up and drank it, and he survived. But as you can imagine, his esophagus, his whole intestinal tract was just burned up, and my aunt and uncle were told he needed to be institutionalized, and my aunt said, no, we'll do it. So with a tracheotomy in his throat and a tube in his stomach through which he was fed, they took him home, and he constantly had to have, as I understand it, the esophagus dilated so the scar tissue wouldn't close it up all the way, and I think it was really painful. I didn't grow up with him, but I imagined a boy having a similar accident and how just one misstep in a life like that can change the trajectory of not only that child's life, but those around him. So he grows up across the street in the novel from his first cousin, Delia, who becomes his defender. He is bullied and tortured, really, by other children because of his weakness and because of his differences, and she is his defender, and they become extraordinarily and unusually close, in large part as a result of the accident, not just because they live across the street from each other, but this creates conflicts and joys of its own.
And this is in small town South Carolina, 1970s?
Right. Well, I've said it in the 60s and early 70s. The book runs from the time these two are children up until, well, adulthood, you know, when they are 20, 21 years old.
And a lot of changes unfolding in the South in the background,
yes,
as the events of this novel are taking place.
Absolutely, and that's part of the conflict too, because in the small town South, it was still quite an insular time. I mean, that's when I grew up, so I know. And yet, the counterculture and all of the rebellions were encroaching on a time that had been, at least on the surface, very staid and traditional. So there's the conflict. And Eli, he falls with the counterculture, and Delia is much more of a traditionalist.
And you have taught English and composition.
Yes.
How did you find yourself making the transition from teaching to writing your debut novel?
The idea for it has been in my mind a long time. The genesis of it was a short story I wrote a number of years ago when it won the South Carolina Fiction Prize. And I just always wanted to expand it from that. But not until I retired from teaching, even though I work as a book publicist now, it is more in a part-time capacity. So I had some blocks of time, and I set out to write the novel, and I did so in the evenings. I'm unusual, I guess, in that regard. And so I would write from dinner time on until I just got tired 4 or 5 nights a week, and I wrote the first draft in about a year.
And Linda, tell us how it came to be that Susan is going to be coming here to Chattanooga.
We have a program we called Southbound, which is bringing different authors to Chattanooga throughout the year. And when we have an opportunity, we hear about an author that has a debut novel, and we get to help launch it. That is just even more exciting to help them really be known and get out there. So we were delighted to host Susan. It's an excellent book. It was picked as an okra pick by the Southern Independent Booksellers Alliance. So it's certainly well worth reading. And I love the fact that she is delving into Southern family issues, things that are going on around in society at that time, and also dealing with trauma that people often don't think about, what it's like to go through trauma in their life.
And delayed reactions to trauma.
Right, right. And though we live 40 or more years beyond the setting of the novel now, what I realized in writing it is that human nature is the same no matter what. We may be more sensitive today to children or even adults who look different or who are not as strong as the normal population, but there's still a stigma. It's not as bad, but there's still a stigma, and children who are different are made to feel that way. I've got a little granddaughter who has malformation overgrowth in one of her legs, and she's in first grade now, and nobody said anything, nobody's noticed it, until this year. A little boy on the playground asked her what's wrong with her, and she went home and talked to her mother and was upset, and she said, I don't think anything's wrong with me, and there really isn't anything. But when anyone looks different, it's just children especially are going to take note of that.
And beyond the release of the novel and the visit here to Chattanooga, what else do you have planned?
Oh, goodness. I've got a big book tour. I have about, well, I don't know, 50-some-odd events for this initial tour between the publication date, wonderful event in Chattanooga, up through June 1st, when I will be in North Carolina in Hendersonville. That's sort of the intense book tour phase. And I've got some other things sprinkled throughout the summer and the fall. That's what's coming up.
And Linda, where can people go online for more information on how to see Susan here in Chattanooga?
Yes, well, Susan is here doing a writing workshop at 5:30 that day, and then she will be speaking about her book at 7. So they would go to just southernlitalliance.org and click on our homepage for Susan Zerenda.
All right, Linda, Susan, thanks so much.
Listen, thank you very much, Ray. I'm looking forward to coming to Chattanooga, and I'm looking forward to doing the writing workshop and to talking about situations in Bells for Eli.
Thanks so much.
What happened to the Cherokee at the end of the Trail of Tears? How did they endure making a new life in Indian Territory, now Oklahoma? Tomorrow, starting at 2 p.m., a program will examine that story at the Moccasin Bend National Archaeological District here in Chattanooga. Will Wilson is a ranger at Chickamauga and Chattanooga National Military Park. Will, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Arrival in Indian Territory. We're talking about what happened to the Cherokee and other tribes in this area at the other end of the Trail of Tears.
Correct. That was the premise behind this program, where we wanted to explore what did occur to the Cherokee after they did arrive in Indian Territory, after leaving from the Tennessee Valley on the Trail of Tears beginning in 1838. So this time frame is going to focus on 1839 to about 1845.
And when they arrive there, they're not alone.
They are not alone. Of course, with the Indian Removal Act, it was not just the Cherokee that were forcefully removed from their native lands in the East. It was the five civilized tribes, as it was known, the Cherokee, the Choctaw, the Chickasaw, the Creek, and the Seminole, were all forcefully removed from their native lands and forcefully marched along the Trail of Tears to Indian Territory, of course, what we know today as Oklahoma.
Once they all arrived there, they brought their prior relationship to that territory, and there they are having to coexist in this new land for them and fight over resources.
Not only that, in a much more reduced land area. So these five tribes that had left the East are positioned in segments of what is Oklahoma, and their area might have some better resources than, say, the tribe that is settled in another area. So the Cherokee and the Creek, who always had a contentious relationship, will find themselves in a precarious position, and not only with each other, but with themselves as well.
And not only less land, but a different type of land for them.
That is exactly right. Some of the resources that was prevalent here in the Southeast is no longer there in their new homeland. The prime example of that is cane, river bottom cane, that is used quite frequently in basket weaving for all of these tribes. They are finding those types of resources less available, and so a way of life is literally not able to continue because that resource is not there for them.
And not only are these tribes from the Southeast having to share this new land amid their prior relationships with one another, they're having to share this land with tribes from other parts of the country.
That's correct. And not only that, the area is already settled by native peoples. You had the Cheyenne, the Arapaho, the Kiowa were already established in that part of the country. And how did they feel about having other tribes infringe upon their areas? So we're going to delve into those stories as well. But not only that, you'll have other native tribes moved from other parts of the country, the Midwest, the Northeast. So the Miami of Ohio will be forcibly removed as well and brought down to the Indian Territory. And what are the dynamics that these tribes kind of face off with one another is kind of what we're going to want to explore.
We know that the removal of these tribes was deliberate. How much of a sense do we have that the placement of the tribes was deliberate as well?
It is deliberate by the federal government. They do already have the areas designated for each tribe divided up, and those tribes are sent to those respective regions of Indian Territory. It is, though, a bit of contention, again, amongst the tribes that were already established in Indian Territory in Oklahoma, and it is something that is going to really cause a lot of friction between these neighboring tribes.
And how are you going to tell this story at Moccasin Bend?
The program is going to take place at our Moccasin Bend National Archaeological District at the Browns Ferry Federal Road Trail, which seems kind of poignant. That is really the beginning of the Trail of Tears. We'll gather at that site to really discuss a few other things. Again, the time frame is going to really focus on 1839 to about 1845. There are several things that happen with the Cherokee within that time frame. Of course, the Cherokee find themselves involved in their own civil war, where the two factions, the John Ross faction that wanted to stay in the eastern homeland and not sell off to the federal government, versus the Major Ridge faction, which are the ones that will sign the Treaty of New Echota, giving away those native lands to the federal government. Once they make it to Indian Territory, fighting will break out between the two, and it's not really until 1842-43 that is resolved. A lot of that happens because of the International Indian Council of 1843. We'll talk about some of that. And then just kind of focus on how they managed to pull themselves through these divisive times.
And when does the dust begin to settle in Indian Territory and that territory begin to resemble what we now know as Oklahoma?
That's going to be another story for another time, I think, because you'll get into the turn of the 20th century when Oklahoma actually does become a state, and all of the five civilized tribes really come together as one and try to make their own territory a state. However, the federal government did not see fit in doing so, and will try to then make it to where what is Oklahoma and Indian Territory brought in together as one state. Oklahoma, the state as we know it, will enter the Union early 20th century, 1901, I believe.
And that's just one thread occurring alongside the American Civil War and all of the other conflicts involving the federal government and the tribes in the aftermath of the Civil War in other parts of the country to the north and to the west of Oklahoma.
Correct. Once those territories that will be expanded upon out west, and of course you have the westward expansion into other native peoples' territory, the fighting, of course, that many are familiar with cowboy shows from the day, is something that Well, certainly have its roots in the Indian Territory, Oklahoma, with the five civilized tribes, the Cherokee, the Chickasaw, the Choctaw, and such, and how the federal government manipulated a lot of what they told these native tribes, the native peoples, how they reacted with what the federal government was saying. But it is still part of our nation's history, and that history oftentimes, you know, we talk about the Trail of Tears, and again, what happens after that? And that's kind of where we were wanting to explore.
And where can people go online for more information?
They can go to the park's website, and that is nps.gov, then /CHCH. They're also welcome to check out the park's Facebook page as well.
All right. Will, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Edible ecology, trail towns, swim runs. Just a few things you'll find in the latest issue of Get Out Chattanooga, arriving this weekend from the Chattanooga Times Free Press. Sonny Montgomery writes for and is an editor of Get Out Chattanooga. Sonny, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
Good to have you back. Latest edition of Get Out.
Yes, it's our spring issue. It's coming out March 1st. This is going to be a really good one. I'm really excited and proud of this issue.
And one of the things in the issue, what we call edible ecology.
Yes. Well, that's one thing you can call it. Another word for it is invasivorism. I think I'm saying that right. But I'm just kind of saying it phonetically, invasivorism. But anyway, so what this is, invasivorism, is this movement. I guess you could maybe call it kind of a subculture-y movement, where it is about eating invasive species as a means to control invasive species. So you look at a lot of the invasive species that are just taking over our region. I mean, kudzu would definitely be one of the biggest ones. So kudzu is definitely edible. It has a lot of history, especially with traditional Chinese medicine. It's pretty good for you. And I've actually had it before. I've actually had creamed kudzu, which was delicious. So this feature, it's one of our cover features, all about edible ecology, right? So it's about this movement of eating invasive species as a solution to control some of these invasive species. So let me just tell you a couple of the species that we talk about. Wild boar. I think most people are familiar with wild boar and just totally rampant problem. What is it? Big South Fork. I think they're having enormous problems with these populations that they do this really destructive thing called rooting when they're eating. So they're digging at soil and they're just killing a lot of native plants. Anyway, they're delicious. So we could all be eating wild boar. Purslane is another one, which is a succulent. Kudzu, silver carp, and then nutria, which, are you familiar with nutria?
No.
So nutria is also, they call it swamp rats. It's kind of like a cross between a muskrat and a groundhog. You find them more predominantly in Louisiana. They're an enormous problem. You know, they're contributing to a lot of erosion, a lot of flooding problems because they're eating away all the stream banks. And they haven't arrived in eastern Tennessee yet, but they're working their way here. And they're tasty and we can eat them. So this whole feature, you know, we talk about these different species, we do a breakdown of the history, how these invasive species got here. We talk about their flavor profiles, and then we went out and we got recipes from local chefs. So yeah, it's fun. I think I learned a lot while working on it, and I think just a lot of food for thought, if you will.
Do you have a favorite recipe?
Well, you know, I've had the kudzu, so I'm kind of most excited about the idea of eating kudzu, just because I've tasted it. I mean, it's super good, and why not? You know, it's everywhere. I think part of the reason that we're not eating more of these invasive species is because there is that taboo that, you know, that they're kind of these gross things that we never wanted here in the first place.
Is it safe? Is it weird? Those kinds of things.
For sure. And I think whenever you talk about foraging wild foods, I mean, obviously there's the issue of safety. The rule being, don't eat it if you're not sure what it is. I mean, come on, we shouldn't have to say that, but we do. We say it in this story. And, you know, I think one of the things with kudzu that we also point out is something you do have to think about when you're eating invasive species like kudzu or purslane is that you have to be very aware of where you're getting this stuff from, because a lot of these things could be been sprayed with herbicide or something like that. So you want to be careful. You want to be smart about it. But, you know, if you have a patch of kudzu growing in your backyard and you've never sprayed it with herbicide of any sort, then there's no reason that you shouldn't be out there harvesting it and eating it. And we have a kudzu quiche recipe in here, so maybe that'll inspire you. And also, I want to say, in regards to this feature, but also in regards to the entire magazine, our graphic design artist, Matt McLean, who did the page layouts on all of these, he killed it this month. I mean, I truly think this is one of our most beautiful magazines, and so I have to give him a shout out. This invasive species story is just gorgeous. So definitely think of Matt when you pick up one of these issues. I mean, he put a lot of hard work into this, and it's quite beautiful this month.
And there was also a lot of hard work put into the guide to trail towns.
That's right. That's another one of our features. So the Appalachian Trail, I think most people are very familiar with the Appalachian Trail. So throughout the Appalachian Trail, there are designated communities along the way. And these designated communities, sometimes they're located literally on the trail. Sometimes the Appalachian Trail will cross right through these trail towns. Other times they might be located 4 or 10 miles away from the trail. They're still connected to the AT in the sense that they have a lot of support for through hikers. So they're offering hostels, they're offering shuttle rides, restaurants that have good deals for through hikers and whatnot. So in our guide to the AT trail towns, we did 5 trail towns. I believe they are all within a 4-hour driving distance. And so it's all about how you can experience some of these trail towns through the eyes of a through hiker. So we look at these towns and we give you where these through hikers are going to be sleeping, where they're going to be eating, where they're going to be shopping, and what sort of shuttle services are available. And a lot of these towns are super cool. I mean, you have Hot Springs, North Carolina. It's just a super cool little quirky town, you know, where they'll have festivals celebrating through hikers and all sorts of little craft breweries and whatnot. So yeah, it's a pretty cool guide. You know, these nearby towns that they're all very small towns. I think that's kind of what's different is that these aren't necessarily towns you would go to otherwise. I mean, so much of their economy is there to support a lot of these through hikers. So it just kind of makes them these unique little areas set in the mountain towns of Appalachian.
Just off the beaten path, but still within reach.
That's right.
And tell us about swim runs. What are swim runs?
So that is our third feature of the month. I knew literally nothing about swim runs. I had never heard of it. We get a lot of pitches. You know, I get a lot of emails from people that I've never met that have story ideas that they want to write for Get Out. As soon as this woman, Sydney Mason is her name, she sent me this email talking about swim runs, and none of us had ever heard of swim runs before. And so it's so great and rare, honestly, when we get these pitches about stuff that we just is totally not on our radar. But so she did a great job of doing that. So swim runs, they're also called Attilas. And this is a multi-sport endurance race that I believe they originated in Sweden and they've just arrived to North America. So I think last year was the first time you can compete in a swim run and they had one in North Carolina. Sydney and her husband went and competed in it. So a swim run, you might guess, it's multi-sport and it involves swimming and running. So it's basically just this grueling course of trail runs and then swims. But there's a lot of weird stuff about it. And so people should definitely pick up an issue of this and read her account. So she breaks it down. Since she competed in one, she breaks down the training, the gear, all of it. She does an amazing job of doing it. But one of the weirdest things about these races is that you run with partners, right? So you have 2 people competing in a swim run and you have to be tethered together the whole entire time. When you're running, when you're swimming, you're tethered together. And you have to carry all your gear with you, which is also sort of unique to a lot of long-distance endurance races. You know, there's no aid stations. You're not stopping to pick up your swimsuit or your running shoes. You're swimming in your running shoes. You're running in your swim clothes. And you're tethered with your partner the whole time. It's totally weird. But, you know, endurance athletes, they got to keep coming up with some creative ways to torture themselves. So an interesting story for sure.
If you're looking for something to do outside Ironman.
Right. Yeah. If Ironman is not challenging enough for you, perhaps a swim run. And they're in North Carolina, so you don't even have to travel that far to go compete in one if you like.
And the issue is out this weekend?
That's right. It's our spring issue. It's out March 1st. So you can also find all our stories online starting March 1st. But definitely be sure to look around for a copy because they are beautiful, and I'm very proud of this issue.
How can people follow Get Out online?
Well, we're definitely on Facebook, so you can look up Get Out Chattanooga on Facebook. We also have a free weekly newsletter that we put out. So if you go to getoutchattanooga.com, you can sign up for it there. You can find all of our stories. That's probably the best way to do it.
All right. Sunny, thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More after our news with Bill McLean. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Each month, Green Steps here in Chattanooga organizes community cleanups to pick up litter. Tomorrow, Green Steps and students from the group EDGE on this campus, the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, will collaborate on a cleanup starting at 11 a.m. in front of the UTC Starbucks. Jimmy Urcioli of Green Steps and Sarah Farnsley, a faculty advisor for EDGE here at UTC, stop by Scenic Roots. Jimmy, Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How did Green Steps begin?
Green Steps began in a very grassroots way 3 years ago through Alessandra Grzenko. She was the founder of the organization. She moved here from Colorado and saw that the litter situation in Southeast Tennessee was far worse than anything she had seen before where she came from. And that prompted her response in starting a litter mitigation organization.
And describe the mission of Green Steps.
So Green Steps' mission is to eradicate litter in Southeast Tennessee by means of physical litter removal, education, prevention, and also our incentive-based program that involves litter receptacles.
And you have a community cleanup each month, including one partnering with UTC. Tell us more about that.
It'll be Saturday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. That'll be UTC campus and campus adjacent. So we're partnering with UTC's EDGE Club, in which Sarah is the faculty advisor for that. So we're partnering with them to get more student engagement with our program and with the EDGE program here on campus to just invest in environmental work.
And Sarah, for people who may not be familiar with EDGE, tell us more.
EDGE stands for Ecological Decisions for a Global Environment. It's a student-led environmental group on campus. I'm one of the faculty advisors along with Dr. Jody Kasky and Professor Nanda Barbosa. And so the students are involved in a lot of different aspects in the community, like the river rescue that takes place in October, in which trash is collected from around the Tennessee River. It's just a group of students that are very passionate about the local environment, the regional environment, the global environment, as well as campus, UTC's campus.
It's just an idea to raise some awareness about litter, not only in our natural areas, but also in our urban areas. It's just as much of a problem in our city streets and even right here on campus. And just giving students a tangible way to take stock in the place that they reside and educate themselves day in and day out.
Tell us about some of the other things that Green Steps does. I'm thinking the litter stations. I'm thinking the educational outreach.
Sure. So for educational outreach, we'll come to schools or various organizations, events, and just talk a little bit about our program and what we do to mitigate litter in the Southeast Tennessee region, but also discuss the issues regarding what creates litter in the first place. And that is our single-use waste. And so educating on ways that we can reduce that waste, how to properly dispose of waste when it's created, such as through composting, recycling, and landfill as a last resort. We also instill the R's. So it's traditionally been said as the three R's, reduce, reuse, recycle, but we sort of build on that with refuse. So refusing single waste items first, and then reducing the amount of single waste items, and then finding a way to reuse those items, and then also repairing items when they're breaking instead of just arbitrarily throwing them away, and then rot, so that's our composting element, recycle, and then the very, very last thing that you want to do if you can't utilize any of those R's is responsibly dispose of it at a landfill.
And where can people go online for more information about Green Steps, including the event that's coming up?
GreenStepsChat.com. Follow us on Instagram at GreenStepsChat. Those are all with two T's. Same with Facebook, GreenStepsChat. So for our litter receptacles, we have litter receptacles installed all around the city, both in urban and rural areas. And it comes equipped with a trash can compostable bags and gloves and instructions on how you can pick up litter when you're out and about hiking or walking. You can log those points onto our website, greensteps.app.com. You create a username, you log those points, and for every bag of trash, they're 5 gallon size bags of trash. For every gallon bag of trash that you pick up, you get 1 point. 1 point equals $1. Once you get up to $5, you can redeem that for a gift card, and we distribute Amazon gift cards. So you can get up to $30 a month using that program. It kind of is an incentive to pick up litter.
All right. Jimmy, Sarah, thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. Our show is produced by Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, and Will Davis from the studios of WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Follow us on Twitter at scenicroots423 and email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Also, follow WUTC on Facebook and Instagram, and listen online anytime at wutc.org and the WUTC app. Join us again next time for Scenic Roots.